Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And this week, I hope you're nice and loose and like not encumbered and ready to lift some, do some heavy lifting, really.
I am.
Okay, because I don't know anything. About anything, really. But, I mean, most acutely, I don't know anything about sports. Like, I watch...
Outside of the freshman baseball team?
I would actually argue that I don't really know much about that either. But, yeah, no. I track my time because I track my time like I do for everything. And it has been a significant time commitment, a rewarding time commitment, but really a lot of time that you spend down at the baseball field or looking at the weather report or setting a lineup and attempting to outsmart the game, which I think, as we've all seen on a number of occasions, if you try to outsmart the game quickly reminds you that it's smarter than you are. Case in point, the other day we're playing, and it's there are, as I sit here, like I have my hands on the scales and the left hand goes up and the right hand goes down as I'm weighing my options. But, you watch a baseball game. And there sometimes, and we've all seen it, Grady Little would be a good case in point, where you feel like you've gotten everything out of a guy. And you have that sort of tipping point where, and you can't run a control. So it's either I pull you now and you're done, or I leave you out there and I play with house money for a little bit because I feel like I've gotten a little bit more out of it than I should. I'm sure you have a ton of examples of both sides of that.
Well, yeah, it is interesting that you say you can't run a control because it is a small sample size when you're talking about one season and maximum, 15 to 18 games?
I've had 6 games.
Right.
And we're going to play, if the weather holds, we're going to play 9.
Right. But what was the original count? 14, 15?
Maybe 14, yeah.
Right.
Give or take.
Yeah, so even if you play the entire season, that's a pretty small sample size when you're talking about baseball.
It's a small sample size, and really, like, you golf, so you'll understand what I'm about to say. If you're on the golf course, I can go and hit balls on the driving range all day and say, okay, there's water, and I'm trying to avoid that because that's, air quotes, water, close air quotes. But there's no substitute for I'm on 17, and if I go par bogey, I get a 79. Okay, I need to center myself and I need to take that shot and make that shot. There's no substitute for that.
Right.
So as much as I can say to a kid, hey, we'll do a flat ground, we'll do a this, we'll do a that, there's no substitute for hopping on the mound. And you look at games, I started a kid the other day, did a phenomenal job, probably could have left him in longer, but I've been on the other side of the coin where you say, okay, I'm going to send you out there for the next inning and... The next thing you know, basically, it's like somebody just upset the ant farm and there are ants all over the place. And, okay, now how do I reconstruct everything based upon this and based upon the substitution pattern that I had in place that went along? Like, there are a lot of different factors to sort of accommodate that goes along with it. And the other factor that I really never had to deal with ever is playing in the rain.
So the pitching change that you're thinking about most recently, you made it in between innings?
It was a kid gave me 2 good innings, came out and said, I'm still feeling good. And I said, I completely understand. This is what my plan is. And my plan was to go with a non-fireballer, fireballer, non-fireballer, fireballer, which would be the Al Gallagher Isla Borders method.
Uh-huh.
Of I'm going to take Isla and put her on the mound. And Isla's throwing 80 to 82 and lefty with curveballs. And I'm going to run Isla through the lineup one time. And Isla's going to go, and when I bring in whoever, Jason Sigley, throwing 93 miles an hour, there's a random indie ball pitcher. When I bring in Jason Sigley throwing 90 miles an hour, 93, it seems like Sigley's throwing like
103.
Jordan Hicks, yeah. And so you look at the, and that's the closer for the Cardinals, because we don't actually follow sports outside of New England.
Well, apparently
we don't follow New England sport, any other non-New England sports outside of New England.
Well, apparently you've noticed at least one thing other than what's happening in Bedford since
Jordan Hicks is dealing.
He's firing up the radar gun this year.
Yeah, hitting throwing like 104, 105.
105.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I had a plan. I'm like, all right, how am I going to, basically, I'm going to slow down their bats, and then I'm going to force them to accommodate and have an opportunity to win the game. It didn't pan out. You know, there obviously errors are going to happen at any level, particularly at the freshman level. So fair enough. But you look back and I say, well, what would happen in the control environment if I give the kid who threw the first two innings another inning and another inning and another inning, knowing that he's a competitor and he's going to battle? Hey, you know, that tells you, but I don't have the luxury of saying, okay, now I have another time to make this decision. I get to make the decision and I have nine games to make a decision. I had another one back on Monday where first and second, good situation. Kid from first picks up a ball in the dirt, thinks it's getting past the catcher, goes full bore towards second base. Only problem, the ball didn't get away from the catcher. They get him hung up in a rundown. Third baseman's involved in that rundown. I get the guy from second to third thinking, okay, my worst case scenario, they're going to get the out of first base, and then I'm going to get a runner on third base that I can then get home. And of course, now nobody's covering home because the catcher's gone up the line to participate in the rundown. So I send this kid around, and there's a lot of stuff where you're just trying to figure out the speed of the game. And that, it's new for me. I have not coached on a 90-foot base level and been in the dugout at that level. So I send the kid around thinking, hey, nobody's home. We'll have a good opportunity to score. Make them make a play. The other team needs a guy to cover the base, needs somebody to hit the guy that's going to cover the base in stride. He's going to have to make a heck of a tag. And all those things happened. I guess, all things being equal, I would probably try that again. But
what throw was made? Was it the first baseman to the pitcher?
First baseman to the third baseman, who basically ran some kind of a bizarre slant through the infield once he realized that...
Jeter slant?
It was not Jeter-esque, but you know, once he realized that something was going on, he did it and caught the ball and turned to his glove side, and made the tag and got the out by an eye blink, and it is what it is. Later in the game, you have the same kid that I ran into an out at home, hits a triple to right center, ball gets... to the fence, right fielder picks up the ball, misses the cutoff man. The last thing I see when the kid's about, I don't know, two steps away from third base, I see the ball bounding over the cutoff man's head, and I'm still like, I'm waving home Wendell. we all know how that usually went. And so I send this kid around, and sure enough, the second baseman isn't there, but speaking of Jeter, the shortstop is there for some inexplicable reason. Picks up the ball 150 feet from home plate and in one motion fires a strike to home plate. Catcher, bam, tag down, guy's out. My guys seem to think that he wasn't out, that the guy beat the tag. We had one umpire, which again is a vestige of freshman baseball, and he was out, and I said, there's really, like, yeah, you might be right. I didn't see it, but who am I going to challenge it with? There's not right. A soul that I can say, did you see it? This guy's going to appeal to his buddy. It is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard enough to be a one umpire crew without somebody down your neck all the time.
Well, here's the thing. From this chair in the room, even though I wasn't there, I think all those decisions can be supported. With the pitching changes, you know, you have to weigh letting the guy get in trouble in that next inning. But if you do that, then the guy you bring in is coming in with men on and nobody out.
And that was a big consideration for me in making the decision, was I wanted the next guy to come in to have a clean inning.
So there you go.
Because there are a few factors at play. The first factor is I want you to be responsible for your own guys. And yeah, there are some times that you have to look around and, all right, take a breath, reassess the situation. There are also some times that if you come into a game mentally, it can be different for you giving up your own runs versus giving up somebody else's runs. And I'm not, this is a team game, obviously, but we've all been there where, like, okay, I might get three outs, but three runs score. I did my job. Well, you didn't do your job.
Right.
I've been in that situation where that's crossed my mind and I want to slap myself like, dude, that's not the right way to think. So, you know, you don't want to give up your inherited runners, but it's difficult to come into a game in that situation. Another thing, case in point, guys on second and third, same game on Monday. The correct thing, and this is just me gaining familiarity with high school rules, I could have said, give me a four-pitch dead ball walk, send that guy to first base, and now and bring the infield in. Now I have the chance to cut runners down at the plate. Pitcher's got to pitch differently. He's got to shoot low. Didn't make that call. It, thought about it immediately after the fact and went, dude, that's ridiculous. And now it's, for me, I need to put myself through mental checkpoints of, okay, each situation, I need to at least take a second and think before I do what I'm doing or do nothing.
Right. Well, before we get to that one, the base running one, the thing I like about that is it teaches your guys to be aggressive on the base paths.
Yeah.
Because if they know that you're being aggressive and forcing the other team to make plays, and if they make a perfect play with a relay or a guy covering home that was out of position, then you tip your cap to them. But it teaches the guys that, hey, if I got beat by a step at home plate, then I have to make sure that when I'm running those bases, I'm going 100%, I'm expecting to be sent home, and then if they do that, then maybe next time they beat it.
Right. It's, and I've said it for years coaching, but it's supposed to be a fun game, and it's not a fun game if you are taking a very cautious lead from second base or taking a very cautious secondary lead away from second base. Like, it's a fun game if you're able to dive back to the base and beat the throw. It's not a fun game if you take a ridiculous lead and you get thrown out going back to the bag. So all these things are learning experiences. For me, they've been good. I just wish we had more games that you have more opportunity to kind of put guys in different situations. And if you succeed, great. If you don't succeed, how do we learn from that? And there's, and that's the other thing. Yeah, we're 3-3. I've had plenty of opportunities to grab a kid as he's coming off the field. Hey, this, hey, that, or hey, I noticed this happened during the game. We need to work on that. The more opportunities that these guys have to execute in games, the better they'll be. And if there's something, and I've said it with a decent degree of frequency, at least as it pertains to my life, it's failing is okay if you learn from the failure. And okay, if this is the error that caused the failure, or the it could be a lapse in judgment, it could be something physically that you're doing that's just straight wrong. If I can learn from that and then not repeat the error, now I'm better than I was yesterday. That's made me a better player. That ultimately is what I'm shooting for with these guys, and I'm hoping that I can shoot for the same thing for myself too.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing about baseball. You have to learn from failure because you are going to fail many, many times. And obviously, offensively, you're going to fail more times than you succeed. So don't beat yourself up about it. I mean, these guys, they still have the chance to succeed or not. And if they don't, they're going to learn from it.
Right. And that's the hope. And that's what coaching is not everybody's Phil Jackson and gets to roll out Jordan and Pippen and Kukoc and Paxton and Luke Longley. And I like, and have this amazing, I just dropped two random dudes in there, have this amazing lineup that goes 72-10.
You not even mentioned Steve Kerr.
Bill Winnington.
Bill Cartwright.
Yeah. Not everybody gets to roll out that lineup and just say, go get them. And occasionally there will be gripes, but the Zen master takes care of it. Not everybody gets to do that. Are there games we should have won that we didn't? Yes. Are there runs we should have had that we didn't? Yes. Hey, I can own all of that sort of stuff. The thing is, I've learned from it. They've learned from it. And it's tough to really make any kind of a judgment six games in. The other bizarre piece of all this, we played three games in about 7 weeks, and then we played three games in 4 days, to which I'm now shrugging my shoulders and
both hands are up together.
Both hands
now
are up. The palms are gesturing like, come on, come at me, bro. So anyway, that's what we got. There's your freshman baseball and life update for 15 minutes. We'll take a quick break, come right back, and talk for the first time. Is it really the first time we ever talked about horse racing?
I think it probably is.
Okay. Horse racing.
Coming up next
on Fox on Sports, Bedford 105.1. Hey, Hey, welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. And I mentioned it before the break. We are going to talk about horse racing, and I don't know that that has ever happened, but I guess if you're going to talk about horse racing, might as well talk about the Kentucky Derby. Might as well talk about it with a guy who was there and had a rooting interest, as did all of Southern New Hampshire. Like, I can't think of that happening at any point in time when I've lived here. The only real connection to New Hampshire for the Kentucky Derby that I can think of, oddly enough, is if you're driving to the beach, you see that Dancer's Image 1968 Kentucky Derby champion, which oddly enough came back into play in this year's race 51 years later. We'll get to that in a second. Dan Casey of Sovereign Stables. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, anytime. So, first of all, I've got to know, tell me, all right, I saw the pictures on Facebook. How long did it take you to get all of that apparel together to go down there? I mean, or is that already part of your wardrobe?
But this trip was probably the hardest thing I think you could ever imagine. Luckily, my brother-in-law, Matt Gassis, is a pseudo travel agent in his spare time. He loves planning this stuff, but it was unreal to try to get all this pulled together. But you know, it turned out to be a pretty spectacular weekend.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a great weekend. Seemed like a lot of fun, and I'll turn it over to Hanson because he's got some more of the actual horse racing questions aside from your sartorial splendor.
Yeah, well, before we get into the Derby day itself, let's tell our listeners a little bit about this horse Vekoma, and you know, how did you first hear about the horse and see it and realize that it could be special out there on the track?
We've been in horse racing for 20-plus years. My father-in-law, Michael Gassis, started believing in buying, you know, greyhounds and running them out in Hinsdale, and then got the love for horse racing when he was a kid. And you know, we grew up going to Rockingham Track down in Salem before it shut down. So he's been around horse racing forever. I think collectively throughout 20-plus years, he's had 250 horses that he's owned. Some big names like a New York bred named Gander that made $1.8 million on the track, winning the Meadowlands Cup and some other big races, and some other pretty big races. He's running the Breeders' Cup, but you know, he's just always been in horse racing, and you know, he's always every year buying, you know, between 5 to 10 horses, and this year some of the pound of a coma out of the Keeneland sale. He's got a partner in the horse, Randy Hill, out of New York, and they were down in Keeneland for the sales, saw Vekoma. He wasn't named Vekoma, just saw this little horse out of Candy Ride and had a funky little kick to him, and they ended up buying him and started training him. And luckily, turned out to be a pretty classy horse and got them to the Derby finally. Neither of them have ever been to the Derby, so this horse mapped out the way and they got this kind of a ton of gems.
I guess that kind of goes to show how difficult it is to find a horse that's going to qualify for the Kentucky Derby when you're buying, you're in a group of investors and you may buy 5 to 10 horses a year, and it takes a long time to find one that's that good. What was the process like for Vekoma to be successful and start winning races to be able to qualify for the Derby?
I mean, it's no different than, I mean, a horse is an athlete, and you know, an athlete needs a coach, and Vekoma, you know, we've been fortunate enough, and as long as that they've been doing this, we've had a couple great trainers. We've always had John Terranova train the Gatson's horses, and you know, with Vekoma, with Michael at Gatson's stable having a partner in the horse, they trade off every horse, they trade trainers, and Vekoma was fortunate enough to get
Yeah, it certainly worked out, and we saw that he won multiple races to gain enough points to qualify. So then take us down to Churchill Downs, the day of the Derby. You're there with your family, and you've got a horse in the race. What was it like to be in that position?
I mean, I don't know if you guys are both into sports, obviously, and Louisville is just a fun town. I was actually, you know, one time I was taking a taxi and went to the Louisville Slugger Museum, and, you know, the kids, first of all, they had a blast. And, you know, Michael, my father-in-law, he's not old. He's 66 years old. Been successful in business, but he's always had this passion. He's always dreamed about going to Derby and to be there with, you know, we had 12 of us in our group. Michael had his brother, executive counselor Ted Gass, is down there with his wife. You know, another local sports legend and Billy LeBurge somehow stuck into the group and he was down there. So, you know, Friday in Churchill, it's the female big race, the Oaks. It's a cancer awareness day, so everyone's down there. Friday's kind of a chill day. Everyone's dressed in pink and, you know, having a good time. And, you know, Derby Day, you know, we stayed at a downtown hotel and we're down for coffee in the lobby at 7 in the morning, and there's people in hats and dresses and suits. And, you know, they're all there for the same thing. It doesn't matter if they're a horse owner or a spectator. They're there for, arguably, I think, one of the greatest events in sports. So the town is hopping, you know, the track is hopping. It's just a surreal experience to not only be there, but, you know, once you put that badge on with your jockey silk that you're in the race, it's just, you know, it's just a different world. It's skip the line, you know, security taking your left when everyone's going right. It was just, it was a really, really fun experience. And, you know, to put it to this way, after the whole thing, I think my sister-in-law wrote, you know, if we had that much fun coming in 12th place, imagine if we would have won.
I would say truer words are never spoken. Yeah, the atmosphere down there, I mean, that's, as a sports fan, regardless whether you're a horse racing fan, going to that race is a bucket list item. And for you to have that opportunity, particularly with that kind of a vested interest, had to absolutely be insane. We're with Dan Casey, who is with Sovereign Stables, that had Vekoma that was entered into the Kentucky Derby and finished 12th. Now, once the race started, your thoughts and emotions, actually, like, now it's go time. Not to mention the conditions on the track were best described as soupy.
It would be an understatement. We actually got the benefit of being able to go out to the barn before the race and walk the horse onto the track from the barn area all the way up, the first turn of the track and into the paddock. And soupy, my son had a poncho on and a baseball hat. And when we got to the paddock with Vekoma, Brody had mud on his hat somehow. It was just, people were walking with no shoes. It was an off track for sure. But I mean, you got 18 horses in the race. Vekoma came in. His mother was a mud horse. Unfortunately, Vekoma never ran him in the mud. But, you know, it was an off track. So, you know, up to race time, you know, it's pouring out. All you want to do is no different than anything else. You just want to get a good start. You want to get out of the gate. So call my guy out of the gate strong, had a clear path. You know, in those conditions, as soon as the horse starts getting some mud picked up in his face, it kind of turns a little bit. But, you know, he got a good grip. First turn was great. Back stretch was great. Again, you're competing against 18, 17 other of the best horses in the world to qualify for that race. So unfortunately, we had around the last turn where Maximum Security created his foul. Vekoma did get pinched a little bit. Probably cost him maybe 3 or 4 spots. It would have been great to finish in top 10, but the horse came out of the race sound, went back to the barn, ears were perked, immediately hit the hay, you know, the feed bag. So, you know, we couldn't have asked for the horse to come out any better than obviously the result, but the horse came out of the race sound.
So what were you thinking about halfway through the race when it looked like Vekoma was in the top 5? And were you thinking, you know, gosh, how is Vekoma going to react here in the mud, since Vekoma's never run in the mud? Or were you thinking, hey, here comes the kick, we actually have a chance at this?
Yeah, it's tough because
Yeah, it's an amazing accomplishment and historic event for you guys. And then, of course, it was a historic race with the controversy. What was your take on what happened with Maximum Security, and what was it like being there at the track waiting for the results to be official?
So Maximum Security was the 7 horse. We were the 6 horse. Our back was right next to the owners. I mean, there's a right when the horse went Maximum Security, the NBC stands for the owners, and my kids are standing right behind the owners. So, you know, you're witnessing somebody, a family, a group of friends at the highest of highs, and you're happy for them. You didn't win, but you're happy that the guys next to you, that you're seeing that joy, because it makes you want to get back there again next year. And then you immediately see, you know, maybe 5 minutes later, an inquiry, and you go from the highest of highs of winning the Kentucky Derby to the lowest of lows. I mean, you can hear a pin drop in that box. And this one, I mean, zeroing out is part of racing. I mean, these are three-year-old horses. They're not mature. They've run three or four races in their lifetime, so zeroing out is part of it. But unfortunately, what happened was the horse went maybe from the one spot to the five spot, five lane in a race, and it affected a third, fourth, and fifth place outcome. That, you know, Kentucky Derby pays out the top five spots. I think if you come in fifth place, you get, I think it's $90,000. But once you start affecting what's going on behind you, not only are you affecting monetary, you know, payouts of from the track, but you're affecting wages. You're affecting trifectas, superfectas. So it's one of those tough things that you're like, well, I mentioned at the beginning, the only other time that there's been a disqualification in a derby was when there was another New Hampshire horse in the race, and Dan's Invincible. It's weird how the stars align for that one.
Yeah, so it sounds like you would trend towards the side of, hey, it's unfortunate, but because he ducked out that far, you understand that the disqualification was made. You would support that decision?
You know, you have to. The only troubling part is this has never happened. And everyone can think, you know, okay, they didn't win the derby, but Maximum Security was the best horse in the race. You know, he won the race, unfortunately got disqualified, but not only is he not a Kentucky Derby champion, but that affects his breeding rights down the way. That affects his stud fee. It just affects so much of that goes into Maximum Security. It's tough to fathom that happening. But, you know, he did veer out. Do I support it? It's racing, but, you know, Stewart, I wouldn't want to be a Stewart in Churchill right now.
No, I would not want to have to make that call. That is and we're here with Dan Casey, who ran Vekoma in the Kentucky Derby. He was part of the Gatsa Stables team. You weren't riding him. You were along for the ride, I guess, as it were. But and you look at sports now and think back to, and Hanson will know what I'm talking about, like the 1985 World Series. You have a guy who's clearly out at first base. He's ruled safe at first base. That changes the complexion of an inning. With instant replay, everything is different. And with the number of angles that we have and the way that we're able to slow things down significantly, even for those of us, if you're just videoing it on a phone, I can watch my kid's game and tell if somebody's safe or out. It has added a very different dimension to sporting events when particularly you think about, okay, if something happens in a football game and 5 seconds run off the clock early in the game, nobody's saying anything. 5 seconds run off the clock late in the game. It's wait a second. Scoreboard operator, please reset the clock to whatever. And almost you wonder, all right, if Maximum Security had made a move like that earlier in the race, would that have been something that would have even been considered? Or was it only a foul or ruled a foul because of where it was in the race and what was going on?
Yeah, I don't think it would have been. You know, there could have been an inquiry early in the race, but it absolutely affected War of Will. It affected some horses that could have probably been in the third or fourth spot, where, again, that affects, you know, that affects position, but also affects, you know, wages, which you have to think about.
Right.
You know, the thing about horse racing is you're not playing just because the horse didn't win. There's another horse that wins. So it's not like Churchill's benefiting by taking the horse down because there's another horse that's going to win. There's probably more, you know, not as much payout, but there's still payout.
And so then there's the talk about a tough sport, and once the race is over, you've got that tough decision of, for all those horses in the Derby, are you going to race in the Preakness? So how did the Vekoma team decide whether Vekoma would race in the Preakness?
Yeah, so I mean, it's pretty much, you think about it and you say, you know what, Vekoma got you to the Derby. He did his part. To be fair to the horse, running 2 weeks after the Derby, horses usually get probably about, you know, three and a half, 4 weeks, sometimes longer off between their next race. So we looked at it, you know, and that there's a bright future for Vekoma. Our family spends a ton of time up in Saratoga for the summer, so, you know, there's no better spot other than the Derby. There's no better spot to be than Saratoga. You know, it's a track up in upstate New York. It's only open for 9 weeks during the summer. It's the place to be. So Vekoma got some rest, shipped back to Florida, started training again. So, you know, they'll map out some races. I think there's a race June 8th at Belmont, the winning season, that could be a potential fit. But definitely targeting Saratoga for Vekoma.
It doesn't seem like a bad time to be a racehorse like that, where you get a few weeks off. But I would have to imagine, too, for the horse, going through the Derby is probably a lot like going through a heavyweight fight, and you wouldn't expect a heavyweight fighter to come back 2 weeks after the fact and defend their title or get back into the ring again. So it's really a difficult ask of the horse, and nice that he'll have a little bit of downtime as well.
Yeah, definitely. He's got a bright future, that's for sure.
Well, I'm glad that you guys were along for the ride. It was certainly a lot of fun for us, having some kind of a local angle in the Derby, and even though he wound up finishing 12th, as your wife had indicated, it was so much fun finishing 12th. Imagine what would have happened if you would have won.
Absolutely.
Well, best of luck this summer. I'm sure you guys will enjoy it, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me.
Take care, Dan.
All right, talk soon.
All right, thanks, Danny. That was Dan Casey of Gatz's Stables. I kept referring to it as Sovereign Stable because that's from... God, probably 10 years ago when we were where I was working, doing a number of things for Mike for Sovereign Stable back in the day. They have since renamed it. I'm not quite as in touch with the whole thing, but they have since renamed it as Gatz's Stables. And a lot of fun just to sit there and say, wait a second, that's one of ours.
That's right.
Yeah.
You don't get that every day for New Hampshire in the Kentucky Derby.
No, you don't get that every day for New Hampshire in the Kentucky Derby, or really in much of any sport at all. And one of the interesting things about being here is, and you're from Maine, so I have a feeling it's pretty similar. In California, it's not. Because of the population density and warm weather and everything like that, you almost get numb to people that are professional athletes that come through the ranks and wind up being a big deal from...
Right now, you're talking about California.
I'm talking about California.
You're not talking about New Hampshire.
No, No, you get used to seeing a lot of football players, basketball players, what have you, playing in high school. And it, you know, there's still times that you go to a summer league game and something like a high school or college summer league game and go, oh, wait a second, we're going to go and watch this guy. But there you get numb to it just because there are way more. Here, when the big stories happen, whether it's Vekoma or Grant Levine or a little league team that's going to districts or going to Bristol or Williamsport, like, it tends to be a way bigger deal just because it doesn't happen all that often, which is precisely what makes it fun.
Yeah, and it's almost like anytime it happens in New Hampshire or Maine, wherever it is, it feels like you're part of it because the state is almost like one entity.
Right.
It's not like Southern California, Northern California, all the different regions that have their own group of athletes that make it. But yeah, and for those two stories, Grant Levine and Vekoma, to have that connection to Bedford is quite cool.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I guess speaking of people coming out of the woodwork, I didn't know there were this many Bruins fans.
Yeah, this is the time
of year. I thought
it
was like Tempesta and Bergeron and a sprinkling of other people. And now everywhere I go, I see people wearing Bees stuff.
Well, it is that time of year. I mean, but if you're trending towards the, you know, fair weather fans.
No, I know they're not. Yeah. And I think I've mentioned this before on this show, but someday New England sports fans are going to wake up and the Bruins are going to be lousy, and the Celtics are going to be lousy, and the Patriots are going to be like 1990s lousy, and the Red Sox are going to be like they're better than they were earlier. Like, they're playing all right now, and they're going to feel what people from other parts of the country feel, where, like, this isn't normal.
It's hard to imagine right now.
Right.
With the Bruins having the chance to be the third team out of the last four from Boston to win the title. That's the thing about how amazing Celtics. That is, that it's the Celtics who might blow that.
Right.
A team that going into the season was as good on paper as anyone. They were the favorite to go to the finals.
How many games did they win?
They didn't win 60.
Okay.
Yeah, they finished in fourth.
Brad Stevens should be fired. I'm totally joking. I'm joking.
Right.
No, but yeah. This is the New England sports fan. Like, you realistically should, you can't, the one thing, speaking of controlling things, the one thing that you can't control for is the leap that Giannis made. Like, I think everybody knew that he was going to have a good year this year. I don't think anybody thought he was going to have quite that leap where I can
perfect,
now say
perfect word for it.
I can now say Giannis, and everybody knows who he is.
Right, and he
has a nickname.
He's going to finish first or second in the MVP voting, and everybody talked about in the offseason, maybe he could make that leap, but he leapt so far that there aren't many people who can say I expected him to make that big of a leap.
I did not think he was going to make that leap, and sometimes you run into basically the immovable object. And in that case, it was Giannis. Like, they were going to be hard. It's the point, like, you're playing Mike Tyson punch out. Eventually you're like, I can't beat this guy. Like, I'm going to need to figure out another way. The Celtics, I will say, if I was looking at it in a vacuum, the Celtics underperformed. I would have thought at the beginning of the year that they would have had a better team at the end of the year than they did. Everybody really likes to get down on Kyrie. I didn't watch enough of it to say whether it falls on him, whether it falls on anybody else, whether there are like little pieces, parts that could have performed better. But and you can feel free to weigh in. I will look at it and say that the New England sports fan is very spoiled. We're talking about a guy like Kyrie, who's still a very talented and very he's. I'm not going to say he's a generational talent, but he's really good. And you look at the supporting cast that surrounds him and say, well, they underperform. We're just time to rebuild. I don't know that that's fair either.
No, that's not fair either. And it is a weird dichotomy because Kyrie, he and Steph Curry are, I think, considered the two best, to have the best handle in the NBA. And only Kyrie has made a game-winning shot in the finals in terms of the guards. So he's in the elite category, and he put up really good numbers this year. But at the same time, it does seem like he had a negative effect on chemistry. It was that saga throughout the second half of the year of him talking in the media about the team, trying to be a leader, having it all backfire. Eventually, apparently, he apologized to the guys. And then it sure looked like they'd gotten it together with a sweep of Indiana.
Yeah.
No slouch as a five seed, but and then they win game one against Milwaukee, but then all of a sudden Giannis and the crew, the deer, they run off four in a row, and so it just fell flat so quickly. But I do think that it was the chemistry. I mean, that had to play a part in it, but really it was just poor shooting, and Kyrie unfortunately was at the forefront of that. Those last three games, he really shot poorly. Some of them were not the best shots, long contested twos, fallaways, but a lot of them were open threes. And I was just sitting there watching that game five, and the Celtics looked like the Rockets from last year in game seven against Golden State. They had a lot of open looks, and just shot after shot would not go down for whatever reason. And, throughout that first half, I think they were maybe down 10, and you're thinking, if they could just make a couple, they'd be right in this. And it just, they just couldn't ever get on track, and so now the offseason fun starts with, will he come back, and Rozier coming out and saying if there's no changes, he doesn't want to come back. So that's what makes me think that the chemistry was still an issue at the end when you start to hear these other stories come out about guys being frustrated.
It, when you look at And Kyrie was a top pick. Don't forget that a few years ago. And there have been many who have flamed out as a top pick. But you look at the fine gradations among top picks. And you look at Harden was the third pick overall and has certainly lived up to that. I would say largely Kyrie has lived up to being the number one pick overall, give or take a little bit of things here and there. But what teams are looking for, yeah, you want the physical attributes. You want a guy who can do everything. But you also, if you're going to be that number one, or I guess in that sort of top five, you need to be, as Allen Iverson, you want me to be the franchise player.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a
why are we here talking about practice?
Well, this leads to a perfect discussion about top picks. And you look at Giannis versus Ben Simmons. Giannis got in the gym. Now he's a serviceable three-point shooter. He'll actually take them with some confidence. And that has made him basically unguardable. The fact that he can make threes, but he can also pump fake, one dribble, and dunk, not just from the three-point line, but he can dunk from half court with one dribble. And so he's got that freak athleticism, but he's starting to balance it out with the outside shooting. Ben Simmons has not. And that's going to be the big question this offseason.
Well, Giannis is also Euro-stepping, by the way.
Yeah, sure. Okay. He's just doing every kind of stepping there is. But the reason I bring this up is because Ben Simmons just had the interviews after they fail in Game 7 against Toronto. Kawhi hits the all-time game-winning shot. What an incredible shot. But Ben Simmons only took 5 shots in that Game 7. And so the reporters were questioning him about it. And unfortunately, his mentality just doesn't seem like it's quite up to par with Giannis. Because he's saying, you know, the reporter is saying, don't you think it would be important for you to take more than 5 shots, become an outside threat? And he's just giving these dead answers, like as if he doesn't even care. That would be important. And well, how are you going to improve that? Well, repetition. You know, why haven't you done that already? You know, because Brett Brown came out and said that it would be important for you to shoot more 3-point shots. And he said, well, I think that was more about just being aggressive instead of wanting him to make 3-point shots. So he hasn't even internalized how important it is for him to develop an outside shot. So what are the chances that he's going to get in the gym this summer and do what Giannis did?
Zero to almost zero.
0.1.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And the Sixers, as much as the process paid off and they had Ben Simmons at the one and they had Markelle Fultz at the one, it's almost like they were going solely on physical attributes of guys and doing nothing. Like, have we learned nothing from Ryan Leaf? And I still remember leading up to that 1998 draft, it was bizarre, like random connections. So there was a guy that I used to work with whose like uncle or something like that was quoted a lot leading up to that 98 draft. And what his role was to basically evaluate with people what their Myers-Briggs personality type was. So you have introvert, extrovert, judging, feeling, whatever. And he came out and said, one of these guys is going to be, and it was Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf, one of these guys is going to be a generational player. The other guy is going to flame out spectacularly.
Sure
Guess
enough.
Who's who? Like, I mean, but there are, you have tools to figure that out. And it's not a matter of like the NFL combine asks ridiculous questions of guys and hands them a paperclip and says, you have a paperclip. What can you do with a paperclip? That's stupid. That doesn't teach me anything. But what I want to know, and this goes back to the coaching, I want to know, is a guy going to have leadership qualities? Are guys going to listen to him even if he does have the leadership qualities? Has he demonstrated those? Is he going to be self-aware enough and not have a massive ego that prohibits him from saying, well, I need to work on this? And when the bright lights are shining on him, and they will, is he going to turtle? Or is he going to, as much as New England hates LeBron, you have to give LeBron credit for the fact that he's had bright lights shining on him for 20 years and he doesn't back down. Like, I'll take the spotlight. I'm not afraid of the spotlight. And some of these guys come out at one and they're just not ready for it. And you look at that Cavs team, sure, they won a championship with LeBron there, basically sucking all the oxygen out of the room so that Kyrie didn't have to worry about being the guy. Now that he's the guy, sometimes that's not a comfortable situation for people.
Yeah, and so that'll be fascinating to see is how he reacts to this. Is he able to grow? Because, you know, you mentioned the social stuff, the popularity. It seems like he's as happy with the fame and fortune and being an all-star player. He's a great player. He plays hard. You know, he defends hard. He's unselfish. There's a lot to like about his game. But the question is, does he want to be great? Does he want to be as good as he can be? And we know that LeBron does that. Giannis is doing it. And the next guy we'll compare him to is Damian Lillard. You know, he's had his coming out party in this postseason.
That should have happened a long time ago, by the way. Not that's no reflection on him.
Right.
That's just it's more of a reflection of national sports media. Like, you have slept on him and slept on CJ McCollum for way too long. Like, those guys, if they were in New York playing for the Knicks, that would be all anybody would want to talk about.
And he's just so old school. He's so fun to watch the way that he does it, the way that he is with his teammates. And everything you hear about that guy is positive. And so it's been fun to see that. And so I've been reading about it a little bit more. And apparently in college, he never went out. He was
at Weber State.
Yeah.
In Utah. Like, I mean, your opportunities aren't.
No, but when his teammates were out socializing, he was in the gym late at night. I mean, first in the gym, last to leave. And he just had a mindset, apparently, right when he stepped onto campus as a freshman about making the NBA. And he, you know, you hear about him in the gym in the playoffs late at night.
But not for nothing. Can you think of any other players from Weber State? I can think of one.
I can't even think of any others.
That's the thing. Like, if you're going to make the NBA, I can think of one, and I'll throw the name out. Harold the Show Arsenault.
Don't know him.
Oh, NCAA tournament. If you're coming out of Weber State, it's not a hotbed. It's not a hotbed for NBA players. And if you're wanting to get there and be seen, you have to make clear that you're transcendent. It's not like I'm going to be first, second round guy. Like, you have to give somebody a reason to come find you.
And he did. And so that's been awesome. Now he's faced up against Steph Curry, and Golden State has figured it out so far. And it's been fun to watch them these last 3.5 games without Durant. They're back to the old Golden State Warriors, who the ball is just zipping around and they're making each other better. And that's been a lot of fun to see Steph get back in that role where he's the clear leader and he's just doing magical things on the court again.
The other night he was making just absurd threes, and you watch the game and it's like the classic NFL kickoff returner where you yell no, no, when he throws up the shot. Okay, I guess that was a good shot from there.
Right.
But for guys like him and for guys like Dame Lillard, there's really, as much as Paul George wants you to think that there are bad shots, there aren't. Like, there just aren't.
No, I mean, Lillard has hit, more than 50% of his shots over 30 feet in these playoffs?
Yep.
So it's not a bad shot when he takes it.
And getting back to that Raptors-Sixers Game 7, the only problem I had with all of the hullabaloo about the game-winning shot is the fact, to me, it's one thing if you're down by a point and you hit that shot and it's the difference between winning and losing the series. But if he doesn't make the shot, they still go to overtime.
Right. No, it's not the most impressive game winner ever in terms of the pressure.
No.
Because it was a tie ball game at home. But the way that the shot went in.
Oh, dude. And
incredible.
And credit to the sound guys. Harry will like this. Credit to the sound guys, because they had the mic on the rim turned up loud enough that you could hear it going doing, doing, doing.
Yeah, four bounces off the rim.
Yeah.
Two on the front, two on the back.
I don't get that role.
Yeah, right. Well, he said, that's funny how he called it a shooter's role in the interview after the game. It's not your typical shooter's role, but that's what he got that day.
It was absurd. So, yeah, it's been entertaining to watch, to say the least. I really do wish, you know, and I know New England's happy that the Bruins 1-4. I really do wish that we had gotten a game or two more out of that series and fewer blowout wins.
For the Bruins?
Yeah. just from a suspense standpoint, because everything seemed to be over. Like, you'd turn around and they'd pick up a couple goals, and you're like, well, I guess this one's over. I don't have to watch anymore, which makes it a little bit, as a fan, and as a fan who just, I like suspense. Like, I would be lying if I told you I lived and died with the Bruins. Like, I will root for them because my buddies root for them. But as far as, like, having the pit in the stomach feeling, I really don't. It's fun to watch, and I love to yell at the TV with everybody else. But it's hard to yell at the TV when you're winning 4-0.
It is, but careful what you wish for with hockey, because you're down. If you're up 3-1, it's much easier than in any other sport to come back. And so, you know, sure, 6-7 game classic series would be more exciting. But if I were a fan, I would just want to. I just want to secure that Stanley Cup as any way possible. If it's a 4-game sweep, fine, whatever it takes.
Right. I mean, you obviously take what you can get. So, and then.
You're becoming a Boston fan where you say, I just don't want a championship. I want drama too.
No, I like, as a sports fan, I enjoy, put it this way. You don't, if the Raptors are winning by 30 points in that game, you don't get the buzzer beater from Kawhi.
True.
You know, if the Dodgers are beating the A's 11-0, you don't get Kirk Gibson hitting a game winner. Like, the things that you remember and I remember and that our kids will remember if they're watching a game are the big game deciding plays. It's not a first inning home run. It's a walk off in the ninth. It's a game saving catch by JBJ. Like, that's the stuff that's why we watch. Like, you don't watch a team win by 20 or 30. Like, at this point, my loyalties of being an LA sports fan outside of, yeah, the Dodgers are okay. I couldn't honestly tell you how they're doing right now. Dodgers are fine. If we get to the World Series, hey, cool. But of being an ardent fan, those days are long gone. Really, the only LA sports team that I have a vested interest in is USC. And even that's harder by the day because of things on and off the field. But and for New England sports, yeah, it's more fun for me when they win. But what I really want more than anything else is I want guys to, and I want the performance under pressure, the thing where you just scratch your head and you say, how did he manage to calm himself to make that shot? How did he make that shot over Joel Embiid? Like, that's the stuff that I want to see, because to me, that's more amazing than anything else is how, like, there's no way if you gave me 10,000 times to make that shot over that guy that I would make that shot. He had one chance and he made it.
Right. Well, that gets me thinking about the PGA Championship.
I knew you were going to go there. There you go.
Brooks Koepka. I mean,
boo.
Wow. What a first round. We're taping this on Friday morning, so he hasn't teed off yet in round two.
I'm still moderately annoyed we're not there, but that's okay.
Yeah. Shooting 63 in the first round in the same group as Tiger. What an incredible statement. I mean, he just hit putt after putt. 10, 15, 20, 25 feet. He was hitting bombs all day long. Bogey-free 63 on that monster of a course. What a statement in round one.
Yeah, for him, good round. Tiger didn't, you know, of course, you can't go 30 seconds talking about golf without saying the name Tiger Woods. Was two over yesterday. But to be fair, I mean, he hadn't played since the Masters, so that's understandable. And then also the strange thing this year is how early the PGA is, and the fact that the weather in the Northeast has just been rotten.
And that course has gotten tons of rain.
Yeah.
And, you know, 6 weeks ago, there was still snow on it. And so everybody's really impressed with how they've worked to get it ready for this championship. But yeah, the weather has played a factor because it was cold and wet during the week leading up to it. Tiger didn't practice even here as much as he would have liked. The day Wednesday, he didn't practice at all. He didn't come to the course, and everybody's wondering, is he tired? Is he hurt again? But it seemed like he was just managing his body because he has to now with all the surgeries he's gone through. But if you add in, it's one of the toughest walks in golf with cold and wet. You know, that puts a lot of challenge on a 43-year-old who has the mileage on him like he does, who's, you know, trying to take care of his back and be at full capacity for the 4-day weekend.
Yeah, it will not be easy. And of course, we'll see what the cut line does after today as well. But it's not like playing in Augusta in April where it's going to be a little bit warmer. The weather has been gross. We're probably going to get about a week of spring before the bugs come out, and summer kind of falls upon us like a gross mass of humidity. Like, I mean, that's really all we're going to get out of it. But yeah, it will be. Who do you like to win it?
I mean,
I know you got some kind of something going on.
Well, it has to be Koepka. I mean, the only question mark going into this weekend was the draw that he got the Thursday morning, because it was going to be wet and cold, and it was supposed to be sunny and mid-60s Thursday afternoon, and then he plays this afternoon. It's supposed to be windy. So, but he just dominated that with the 7-under. So, you know, it's his to lose. He's coming off that win at Bellerive, and it's like he picked up right where he left off. It's like all he knows how to do in the PGA Championship is shoot in the 60s, and he shot a 63 at Bellerive, and here he is doing it again. You know, I think they said there have been 37 63s in major championship play, and he's had one in back-to-back PGAs. And going into this tournament, I paid a lot of attention to the press conferences, because it was really fascinating with the mentality that some of these guys had and how it comes out in the media with golf. So Brooks, he's just sitting there so calmly talking about how confident he is, how he feels like, you know, he's the guy to beat, and he went out and showed it. I mean, there's just no hesitation in his game. He feels great about it, and you know, he's living that out. And so he's the guy to beat. And then the fact that all these other guys have to hear that, and then they come out yesterday in round one and see that he's already posted this 63. I mean, they've got a real uphill battle mentally to try and deal with this guy who's, you know, right now playing as good as anybody. You almost forget that he came in second at the Masters because of all the Tiger talk, but Brooks is turning the dialogue right back onto him.
Yep. Whether he smiles or not, I guess I don't have to like his personality. All I have to like is his ability to hit a white ball in a fairway and get it in the hole.
That's right.
That's really it. Don't have to. He doesn't care whether I like him in New Hampshire.
No, he doesn't. But he seemed to be softening. That was the other thing in this press conference. He seemed to be softening a little bit on that and saying, you know, maybe in the past he was, you know, he didn't really take the right approach with the media. So he's sort of owning up to that a little bit, and he says, yes, in the end, I you know, it doesn't bother me what you think, what you say, if you like me or not. But I think he's adjusting a little bit with that.
He's like Shooter McGavin and Happy Gilmore. All right, another show has passed us by. Thanks to Dan Casey from Gatsa Stables for joining us, my co-host Andrew Hansen, Harry Kozlowski, Bill Jennings, Colin Richardson. And that is all. So enjoy your sports week. Hopefully you get a little bit of sun.